Hi, this is Gary Meese, back again with the case against, and we're going to call this episode 34. I did have a couple of episodes in between about the Garrett Phillips, Nick Henry case, and I'm going to drop them out of the count, because basically my count on these episodes now is going to be the West Memphis 3 related episodes, and anything else I have will be, they'll just be sort of out of sync as far as the episode numbers. I don't think anybody cares except me, and I don't know that I care that much, but anyway, that's what I'm going to do. Make sure I'm doing this right in terms of the feed. Bear with me a second. Well, it's looking at least okay so far. I'm going to talk. We're going to get back into the Jesse Miskelly confession of June 3rd, 1993. But I wanted to say before we got into that I watched another documentary. It was a documentary series on, I think it's on HBO, on the Free Meek, which is about the rapper Meek Mill. Now, I don't mind confessing that I may have seen some reference to this guy someplace at some point, but I had no idea who he was. After some brief samplings of his talents, if he has talents, I can understand why I have no real interest in his talents, his music, if you want to call it that. I mean, there is some music involved, but you know, his role in it to me is, as far as music, in terms of his direct contribution, is, it just simply eludes me. It's just some guy talking real fast, which puts me in the camp, definitely puts me in the boomer camp, and I'm okay with that. That's not really the issue. His music is not the issue. He could be singing country music, and I would have many of the same issues with this particular so-called documentary that I have with it as it's presented. And one of the most disturbing things is it's not by some... it doesn't even give the semblance of some sort of objectivity or some sort of distance from the subject. In many cases, this is a false distance. Joe Berlinger is a good example, or Liz Garbus in that Nick Henry thing. She gives an illusion, at least, that she's being objective, even though she's fully in the Nick Henry camp. Of course, Berlinger is perfectly willing to put the blame on innocent family members of murder victims rather than actually look at who did the killings. So, you know, he's beyond contempt as far as I'm concerned. In this case, there's no murder involved. The initial... impetus for this rapper, the Philadelphia rapper, and he's apparently well known in Philadelphia, maybe around the world. Was a drug arrest. It was involved with him, and he had a pistol in his possession at the time, so he was arrested for that. And there was drugs involved. I don't think there's any suggestion that he didn't have a pistol. or that there weren't drugs involved and he was arrested coming out of a drug house. Even this documentary doesn't seem to dispute all that. So, you know, he was up to something either pretty shady himself, or he was hanging out with some very shady sorts of people. And they just sort of excuse all this as, well, this is just what we do in this community. Well, if the whole community is nothing but, if that's all the community is nothing but people who shoot each other, run around with illegal firearms, sell drugs to each other, and as we see in this, you know, don't feel the need to conform to the standards of the law, then basically what we have is a lawless community. And if that's what you want to have, then that's fine. You need to pay the you should be paying the consequences. And this is where we get in. This is where we get into a problem with this, because apparently we're not supposed to have a problem with any of this criminal behavior. And some of it is relatively minor, and some of it is, some of his probation violations are simply not following the, and he was in trouble mostly for probation violations after the initial arrest. But the fact is he set himself up to be a part of the justice system by carrying a gun and hanging out with drug dealers. And to stay out of the criminal justice system, all he had to do was show up in court, basically comply with what the courts wanted him to do. And he didn't do it. He didn't do so repeatedly. It looks like he had close to 30 different violations over 12 years or so. And, you know, there's all sorts of excuses. Well, that's just the way the business is. Well, you know, it's too bad, but, you know, you set yourself up for this to begin with. To me, the thing that's probably one of the things that's most problematic about this, it comes in, a couple of things that come in toward the end. And this idea that pops up, that's also like one of Ava DuVernay's central theses, based on the 13th Amendment, that basically being involved in the criminal justice system, if you're involved in the criminal justice system, you are a legal slave, because the 13th Amendment allows this exception for involuntary servitude in terms of incarceration. Now, we'll set aside the whole idea that young men are being asked to sign up for selective service, which is involuntary servitude, if it's implemented. And thousands and thousands of young men were forced to join the military, whether they, my age, were forced to join the military, whether they wanted to or not, go fight in a war that they may have been opposed to or certainly didn't want to be a part of. And many of them died as a result. And that, to me, is, you know, that is a form of involuntary servitude. And just because the selective service system is not being implemented now doesn't mean it couldn't be implemented in the future. Nobody is campaigning. Is anybody talking about that? Is anybody talking about that on the national stage at all? No. And the fact that it's applied just to one sex just further complicates the issue. And nobody wants to address that either. However, the problem is, you know, with Ava DuVernay and Jason Baldwin, they talk about Jason Baldwin talks about working in the slave fields of Arkansas, which is a joke. And Ava DuVernay talks about being in prison as a form of slavery. But now, according to this documentary, simply being on probation and parole is also a form of slavery, because you're subject to the whims and vagaries of the criminal justice system. Now, generally, and the irony in this is when Meek Mill was taken to court originally on those original charges, and he had 19 charges, a couple of serious felonies, including assault. Assault on a police officer with a handgun, which is one of the charges, is a very serious charge, and the crack cocaine possession is another serious charge. And, you know, he got a shortened sentence. He got a very short sentence and 10 years of probation. And they, at the time, that was judged to be a real blessing. And the court set it up as, well, I'm going to give you a break. So, you know, maybe perhaps you made a mistake. It's time to straighten this out. So that is generally how probation and parole is viewed by most people. And most of the general public looks at probation and parole as a somewhat compassionate measures for dealing with criminals to sort of help get them straightened out, keep them in line, and hopefully they'll do better in the future. In other words, it gives them a chance to do better rather than just simply plopping them in prison for the length of term. But now we've upped the game. So not only is prison, no matter what you're charged with, apparently it's a form of slavery if they ask you to do anything. And you know what? I'm okay. Just plop them in cells and let them sit there. Just lock them up. Don't worry about putting them to work. I'm okay with that, and I think a lot of other people would be too. Just let them sit there. They don't need to earn privileges. They don't need privileges. Just let them sit there. Since the ones who are going to reform themselves are probably going to do it without the help of the system anyway. But going to prison is slavery. Now, probation and parole are slavery. Apparently, obeying a traffic law, when you get down to it, is a form of slavery. In other words, the only thing that will really work for these, the logical endpoint of all this is anarchy, in which there is no rule of law. And that it does seem to be where we're headed with this. Except on the other side of this, in which all sorts of rules and regulations are proposed and implemented on such things as, I mean, we haven't quite got to the point where we're putting people in jail at this point for hate speech in this country, but we're getting closer there every day, and it is a real problem in places like England and Europe. So, you know, actually committing real crimes, stealing from people, robbing people, killing people. We're decriminalizing those actions, finding excuses for those, and turning what most, up until recently, nobody considered to be a crime into crimes. And I guess the people who are proposing that parole is involuntary slavery would be perfectly fine if somebody's going to be thrown in jail for hate speech. I'm suggesting that's a real possibility and likelihood, given the nature of the political polarization in this country. And to me, this is all somewhat insane. And what's happening is we're decriminalizing crime, you know, and this is being pushed by people, by elites who are going to exploit the chaos that's going to come from this, but they're not going to be personally affected. You know, very little crime is going to come home to them. Occasionally it will, just by accident, but for the most part, they're going to live in enclaves where they're not going to be touched by the crime in any kind of meaningful personal way, and the resulting chaos is something that they can exploit for their own purposes. And meanwhile, they get to feel good about all this because they're, a lot of this has to do with, in this particular instance, the guy's black, and they make a big deal out of the fact that he's black, and the blacks are all being mistreated by the criminal justice system. And this is mostly because blacks commit a lot of crimes. They commit a disproportionate amount of crime. It's unfortunate, but it's true. And the only way that we can solve this problem and make the criminal justice system less of a problem for the black community under the way things are going presently is to simply make crime less of a problem for the black community. In other words, fewer impediments to committing and getting away with crime. Meek Mill is not a big-time criminal, but he's certainly no saint either. And I'm going to go into some more detail about this in a later podcast. I probably already talked enough about this. Just came and, you know, being a little bit inarticulate as I tend to be at times. I'm still formulating my thoughts. I'm really better at writing stuff down than I am talking off the top of my head, but I don't learn my lesson and I just start jabbering. But anyway, I'm going to get into the confession of Jesse Miskelly Jr. And we had already established that they're talking to him on June 3rd, 1993. Brian Ridge, Detective Brian Ridge, and Chief Inspector Gary Gitchell are going to be involved in these confessions as far as taking the confessions. And let me see if I can find exactly where I broke off. I may not get it exactly right. Miskelly had just got through describing where the cuts were made on these boys, on Stevie Branch and Christopher Byers, accurately describing what happened. Information that was not known to the general public. And he had set out time and time again to establish that he left the scene of the crime, and he kept putting, you know, from the very start, he tried to get himself off the scene just as soon as possible. The officers would bring him back, then he would describe a bit more, then he would say, and then I left, and they would bring him back again. He would talk more. And finally, Brian Ridge took Miskelly's story at face value and went back and tried to reestablish the times of this occurrence. I'm going to say that on the front end, he wasn't successful in doing this. Miskelly had said this occurred in the morning, which it patently did not. Everybody knew that. Ridge asked him, "Okay, and when you left, did you hear any more hollering or anything?" Miskelly, "No." "All right. You went home, and about what time was it all this took place?" "About," Ridge, "I'm not saying when they called you. I'm saying what time was it that you were actually there in the park?" in Robin Hood Hills, which is in West Memphis, Arkansas, was sometimes referred to as the park. It's not a park, but that's how they referred to it. It's a large wooded lot at that time. Miskelly's answer. Ridge says, "What time was it that you were actually there in the park?" Miskelly's answer, "About 12. So Miskelly changed the times, contradicting himself from just minutes earlier when he said he was there about 9. And Ridge says, "About noon?" Miskelly, "Yes." Ridge, "Okay, was it after school had let out?" He's working real hard to try to get a better time on here. Miskelly, "I didn't go to school," which is, you know, one of those non-direct answers that he's saying he didn't go to school. Well, he didn't go to school because he was a high school dropout, so he never went to school. That was irrelevant, but Miskelly, instead of being direct in his answer and saying, "Well, yeah, it was either before school was let out or it was after school was let out," Miskelly says, "Well, I didn't go to school." Now, soon, Baldwin's mother, signing Miskelly's deliberately misleading statements, would be angrily protesting her son's innocence on the ridiculous basis that he had been in school that day. For all I know, she's still making this incredibly stupid argument. It seems like that might be the case. She's might be fair to say she's incredibly stupid. Ridge, "These little boys." Miskelly, "They skipped school. They were going to catch their bus and stuff, and they were on their bikes, and so..." Now, Miskelly's just making stuff up here. Ridge, "All right, they were on their bikes. Where were their bikes at?" Miskelly, "They laid their bikes down when they came out to the... when they hollered for them to come out there." Ridge, "Had Damien seen these boys before?" And Miskelly says, "Yes." Miskelly had told a story which persisted into later confessions about Eccles targeting those particular boys. Ridge, "Has he done things with them before, or had he just been watching them?" Miskelly, "He had been watching them." Ridge, "Has he ever had sex with them before?" Miskelly answers, "No, he's been watching them." And take note, Miskelly rejected the implicit suggestion in Ridge's questions that they were trying to elicit certain answers, or this was a coerced false confession, and that they'd gone over earlier and tried to drum these answers, this fabricated story into Miskelly's thick head, that asking questions about had he done things with them before, or had he had sex with them before, those would be triggering leading questions that would lead him to give the answers that the officers would ostensibly be looking for, which is, "Oh yeah, he's had sex with them before. Oh yeah, he's done things with them before." Instead, Miskelly says, rejects that suggestion that he'd had sex with them before, but he says he's been watching them. Ridge affirms, "He's been watching them. You mentioned earlier that one of the meetings you went to with this cult thing, they had some pictures. Describe those pictures for me." Miskelly, "They had some trees, houses, trees and stuff." Ridge, "Okay, had somebody taken pictures of these boys?" That's pretty much on the nose, isn't it? He can either say yes or no. And Miskelly says yes. Ridge, "Were they in the houses or were they in the trees when they took those pictures?" "They were in the houses." Ridge, at the houses, did they take like one picture of one boy? Miskelly, there was a group of pictures of all three of them. Gitchell tried to reestablish time frames. Now, did you say that the boys skipped school that day? These little boys did? Miskelly, yes, they were going to catch. They were going somewhere, and like I said, Damien and them left before I did. I told them I would meet them there and stuff. And it was early in the morning, and so they went ahead and met me. They went on up there, and then I came up later on behind them. Now, this differed from what he'd said earlier and from what he described in later confessions, that all three of the teens had arrived together. Gitchell, what time did you get there? Miskelly, I got there about 9. Miskelly, again, had changed the times. He just said he got there about noon, and then he turns around and says he got there about 9. Gitchell, in the morning. In the morning, question. Yes. Gitchell, Wednesday morning? Yes. Ridge, what time is it right now? Right now? Ridge, yeah, you don't know what time it is? Gitchell, do you not wear a watch? Miskelly, it's at home. My dad woke me up this... He says my dad woke me up this morning. I guess his dad did wake him up that morning, but he was sleeping over at Vicky Hutchinson's house when his dad woke him up. Ridge, so your time period may not be exactly right in what you were saying. With the answer of right, Miskelly admitted that he had a poor reference as to times, but in later confessions, his description of times became fairly accurate and in accord with the likeliest scenario for the murders. But, you know, Ridge kept trying for clarification. It was like earlier in the day, but you don't know exactly what time, okay, because I've gotten some real confusion with the times that you're telling me. But now this... this 9 o'clock in the evening call that you got, explain that to me. Obviously, Ridge was, Gitchell were pretty frustrated with the times. They acknowledged there's a real problem with these times, and this comes up over and over. This comes up in criticisms of this confession about the times. In fact, it is the central sticking point for a lot of supporters. Well, he gave the wrong times. Well, he did. It doesn't mean that the rest, he also gave a lot of information that only somebody who was there would know. It was not known to the general public. He gave very accurate descriptions of the setting, and that somebody who was not there would have no idea about. So it's not as if all the details are being fed to Miskelly and he's spewing them back out according to some sort of script. In fact, there is no script. Miskelly's just improvising, and one of the improvisations that he's in terms of making some things up, he is doing some of that. And some of the improvising he's doing revolves around the times. And the times are totally not in accord with reality. Now, if he's making all the other stuff up about who was cut, where they were cut, the physical layout of the land, where the bodies were disposed of, etc., etc., well, if he's just making all that up, he's a remarkably lucky guesser and a remarkably perceptive improviser, shall we say, to the point that he might be one of the most perceptive young men in terms of just picking up nonverbal cues from the police officer that might exist in the whole world. That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is here's a not very bright young guy who is confessing to a crime that he feels guilty about, but he's trying to let himself off the hook and he's trying to give himself some outs, which is what usually happens. Happens in the Central Park 5 case where, oh, they, you know, everybody blames everybody else for the involvement in the rape. But somebody did the raping, and of course it turned out to be, that's another case. But, you know, it turns out that, you know, responsibility gets spread around, but nobody wants to take responsibility on their end. Though they end up doing it inadvertently because, like Miss Skelly, they don't understand the full implications of what they're saying and doing when they're telling police they did this and that, and a murder or a rape was a consequence of their actions. Anyway, Ridge is asking about this 9 o'clock phone call that apparently that supposedly went on between Jason and Damien. Again, this seems to be very problematic as to whether this ever actually occurred. Miss Skelly, well, after all this stuff happened that night that they'd done it, and I went home about noon. Then they called me at 9 o'clock that night. They called me. Now, one reason that this is problematic for Miss Skelly, the 9 o'clock phone call, as Miss Skelly later claimed he was wrestling in Dias, Arkansas at that time. An alibi that actually isn't an alibi, because he could have participated in the killings and still have gone on the wrestling trip to Dias. But the whole idea of the Dias wrestling trip was shot down in court based on a receipt that showed the events described occurring on a week earlier. So he didn't really have that as an alibi in court, if presumably it would have given him one anyway. His other alibi was that he was involved in some police calls to the trailer park. And the problem there was, yeah, all the sketchy denizens of the trailer park may say, oh yeah, Jesse was there, though they gave wildly differing stories about what Jesse was doing during his time at the trailer park that evening. But the three law enforcement officials who showed up at the scene at these police calls and knew Miss Skelly said he wasn't there. So who are you going to believe? The sketchy denizens of the trailer park are three police officers, none of whom had a reputation riding on whether the case against Miss Skelly held or not. It was not, they were not involved in the murder investigation beyond the fact that they were called as witnesses on his so-called alibi. Two of them were in Marion Police Department. The other was in the Shelby County Sheriff's Department. Anyway, Ridge asked, he's talking about Jason and Damien. He said, and what did they tell you on the telephone, Miss Skelly? They asked me how come I left so early and stuff, and I told them I couldn't stay there and watch that stuff no more, so I had to do something to get out of there. Ridge, okay, who called you, Skelly? Jason. Ridge, and you mentioned that you heard some voice in the background? I heard some dingling. Ridge, and what else? I think you said that he made the call from his house? Miss Skelly, he made the call from his house, and Damien was hollering in the background saying, we done it. What are we going to do if somebody saw us? What are we going to do? Now, the story about the phone call popped up again and again in similar detail. There's little credible evidence that either Baldwin or Eccles was home at 9, though both apparently were home soon afterward. And, of course, Miss Skelly later claimed he wasn't home at that time either. So it's questionable whether this phone call, very, very questionable whether this phone call occurred at this particular time. depending on which story you listen to, Eccles was talking on the phone, though there's no evidence that... If you listen to Eccles, he was talking on the phone to Jennifer Bearden around 9, though according to Jennifer Bearden, she wasn't. In fact, there's no evidence that Eccles was talking to anybody on the phone until 9:20 that evening. Very similar scenario with Baldwin. There's no evidence he was talking to anyone on the phone that evening until he talked to his mother about 9:20, 9:30 that evening when she was on break at her job at the trucking company. Her erstwhile boyfriend, Dink Dent, described this particular phone call, and maybe he's not the best of all possible sources, but he's the only credible, semi-credible source you're going to get from the Baldwin side of things. And he does not describe Jason being home at 9 o'clock that evening. And he wasn't taking phone calls then. Now, they had some unproductive discussion about knives in the confession that I left out. And then Gitchell said, I've got a feeling here you're not quite telling me everything. Now, you know that we're recording everything, so this is very, very important to tell us the entire truth. If you were there the whole time, then tell us that you were there the whole time. Don't leave anything out. This is very, very important. Now just tell us the truth. Miss Skelly, I was there until they tied them up, and that's when I left. After they tied them up, I left. Gitchell, but you saw them cutting on the boys. Miss Skelly, I saw them cutting on them, and then Gitchell. So what else left is there after that? Miss Skelly, they laid the knife down beside them, and I saw them tying him up, and that's when I left. Ridge, were the boys conscious, or were they... Miss Skelly, they were unconscious then. After I left, they done more. They started screwing them again. Now, this raises the obvious question. If he left, how would Miss Skelly know they had done more and that they started screwing them again? This point isn't lost on the police officers, but they're doing their best to get the best answers they can from Miss Skelly. Ridge asked, okay, how were they screwing them when you saw them? Miss Skelly, Jason stuck his in one of them's mouth, and Damien was screwing one of them up the ass and stuff. Ridge, okay, and the one that they were cutting the penis off of, did any of them, are they cutting the penis or whatever was being done, did they have sex with them at all? No. Ridge, did either one of them? Jason did. Miss Skelly seemed to contradict the answer he'd just given, but perhaps he just simply didn't understand the prior question. Ridge, Jason did. Jason was screwing him while Damien stuck his in his mouth. Ridge, okay, how did he have sex with that one? Miss Skelly, he was holding him down like, and Jason had his legs up in the air, and that little boy was kicking, saying, don't, no, like that. Ridge, okay, he had his legs up in the air, all right. What was to keep the little boys from running off, but just their hands are tied? What's to keep them from running off? Miss Skelly says, they beat them up so bad they couldn't hardly move. They had their hands tied down, and he sit on them. Ridge, you said that they had their hands tied down. Were their hands tied in a fashion that they couldn't have run? You tell me. And Jesse says, they could run. They just had them tied when they knocked them down and stuff. They could move their arms and stuff and hold them down like wake up and raise up, and the other one just put his legs up. Now, this doesn't make a lot of sense, and, you know, the police officers are trying to get Miss Skelly to describe the bindings of the boys so that their wrists were tied to their ankles in a very peculiar sort of fashion. Miskelly's saying, yeah, they could run. It does seem more likely what was happening was these boys were, it was 3-on-3. You had three larger, violent teenagers on three small, overwhelmed 8-year-old boys. And they began beating them brutally right from the get-go. Michael Moore did make a run for it. Miskelly chased him down, dragged him back. And so a lot of the boys would not have been in a great position to run with a boy on top of them, dominating them, beating them up, particularly beating them in the head. It's all three of them were beaten brutally in the head, using sticks, really in a repetitious pattern with a stick in the top of the head, you know, three strikes to the top of the head. Sounds like Damien's work, but maybe not. Maybe it was Jason. These were all brutal thugs. It could have been any one of the three that did that. Just has a Damien feel to it with the ritualistic aspect of three blows to the top of the head with his voodoo stick. Okay, so they had them under control. They were there the whole time. You were there the whole time that was taking place. I was there, says Miskelly. Miskelly seemed to say the boys had their hands tied but could run. He also said they could move their arms and stuff and were being held down. His later confessions clarified that the boys were overpowered initially and were beaten and molested before being tied up. This was an area where the initial confession diverged from later confessions, but rather than being a poor attempt at deception, this seemed to be Miskelly's confusing, and clumsy explanation of how he could be there when they were tied up if he, as he repeatedly claimed, had left. Noting that one boy was cut on the face real bad, Ridge asked, "Is that what you said?" Miskelly answers, "Yes." Ridge, "And one of them was being cut on his penis?" "Yes, sir." Gitchell, did anyone use a stick and hit the boys with? Miskelly, "Damien had kind of a big old stick when he hit the first one. After he hit him with his fist and knocked him down and got him a big old stick and hit him." Gitchell, "What did the stick look like? I mean, was it like a big log like that, or is it a stick?" Miskelly, "I would say it was about that big around. I would say about that long." Ridge, "About the size of a baseball bat, maybe just a little bit bigger around." Miskelly, "Yeah." And in fact, the evidence, again, which is not known to the general public, is that these boys were beaten with sticks. Now, Miskelly didn't come up with the initial description of the sticks, but he did describe a big old stick that accorded with the stick that was the size and shape of the stick that would have been used on the three boys. Miskelly indicated that the knife Baldwin was using was about 6 inches long, a folding knife with a regular blade. At trial, prosecutors would argue that a serrated blade, such as that of the Lake knife, was used. Now Gitchell asked them, "Have you ever seen them with a briefcase before?" This was the first mention of the briefcase on tape. Miskelly, "I've seen them once that night. I seen them with it that night." Okay, Gitchell, "Okay, what is kept inside of that briefcase?" They had some cocaine and a little gun. Gitchell, is that when you first saw the pictures of the boys? Yes, out there in Lake Shore. And you saw the Gitchell, and you saw the pictures in the briefcase? Yes, I think when we had that cult. Now, this business about the briefcase being along on along for the killing scene in Robin Hood Hills. Miskell is just sort of adding this in. He says he's seen it with him that night. Once that night, I seen them once that night. I seen it with them that night. It's a little unclear when he's talking about. And then he says, yeah, out there in Lakeshore. So maybe he's not, it's a little unclear, but I think he's not saying that it was actually along for the trip to Robin Hood Hills. It's confusing to me when I read this. And I've read this many times, but I think that is what Miskell is actually trying to say, is he saw it in like the pictures in the briefcase out at Lakeshore. Now, whether that briefcase actually existed, whether those pictures actually existed, I have no idea. Gitchell, they never found them. And Gitchell, okay, now you have participated in this cult, right? Yes. Gitchell, how long have you been involved in it? I've been with it for about 3 months. Miskelly remained fairly consistent about how long he'd been in the cult. Gitchell, okay, tell me some of the things you all typically do in the woods as being in this cult. You know, I'm gonna stop right here. We're going to go on and on about the cult, and I've been talking long enough. I think you can see as people accurately note, there are some problems with the Miskelly confessions, as there usually are with confessions, particularly from young offenders, people who aren't motivated to tell the complete truth because the complete truth would be too damaging to them. And somebody who, in Miskelly's case, is not terribly bright. So you've got that problem on top of everything else. Anyway, that's going to be it for this week. I've talked long enough, and we'll be back again soon with the case against with Gary Meese. This is an excerpt from my book Where the Monsters Go, available on Amazon. It's volume 2 of a 2-volume set about the very complete, very exhaustive, by no means absolutely complete, because the absolutely complete book would probably be 20,000 pages, just everything on the record in a book, but with no context. But I tried to give a complete, rounded, objective look at the case, but from the viewpoint that the three killers were the three killers. I see no evidence to suggest that they weren't. Those books are available on Amazon in print and in Kindle format. There's also a condensed, revised version. A little shorter read, more affordable, fairly complete and comprehensive. Arguably, it cuts out some material that's actually somewhat as extraneous, but I felt compelled to put into the other books just to get it on the record and to look at. L.G. Hollingsworth would be a good example. Is L.G. Hollingsworth actually that important to the case? Probably not, but people do focus on him, so therefore I included a long chapter on L.G. Hollingsworth, for instance, in the books. Anyway, I'm going to sign off for today. I'll be back again sometime soon. And wishing you all well in the meantime. And I'm probably going to be doing an episode on the Meek Mill. I've got to get all of the materials together. This obviously, I could throw some stuff together real fast or talk off the top of my head and get a bunch of things wrong or half right. But what I want to do is put some materials together and give a real comprehensive look at the Meek Mill case, and including the background on such people as the Philadelphia DA, who's advocating for justice reform. Let's see how that works out for Philadelphia. I predict not well. Though many of the residents will be happy to be off the hook on having to show up for court or going to jail or being held responsible for committing crimes, I'm sure that'll be the case. Some of the other residents, the more law-abiding residents, may not be so happy with those results. Anyway, that's enough for me. I'll talk to you again soon. Signing off, Gary Meese.